The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I'm going to guess that this will be one of those programs that you're going to be scratching your head. I'm willing to guess that not a single person listening right now has been exposed to the information I'm going to share today with my guest. And I'm going to ask you now to Twitter and to Facebook as many people as you can to listen starting in 25 minutes to the special guest I have. We're going to give her about 35 minutes. And if needed, I will run into the next program because this is going to be unusual. My guest today is Dr. Judy Wood. She is a professor at Clemson University's Department of Mechanical Engineering, specializing in the research of thermal stress and deformation analysis with optical imaging and biomaterial composition and biomimicry. She's an expert in the field, a very unusual field of interferometry, optic stress analysis to determine the interference patterns and their effects. She's authored over 60 peer-reviewed research papers. What are we going to be talking about with all the background? Her analysis over 40,000 images, video clips, volumes of witness testimony. We will be giving you a completely different analysis of 9/11 today. We wait till we have something unusual, something really unusual to share. I'm holding in my hands now, and you can see this if you video stream by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com, you can see her textbook, Where Did the Towers Go? We're going to talk about something other than what every other expert has discussed, and we have that program for next week, a whole panel of physicists and engineers and architects who are going to give their position on what happened. She stands alone, so alone, I decided to have her on by herself so we have plenty of time. You have not seen her, you have not heard about her, you are not aware of what we're going to talk about. It will simply stun you. And because she is a scientist of outstanding reputation and she has a brilliant mind, you cannot simply dismiss what she's going to say as simply nonsense or conspiratorial imagery. No, you're not going to be able to wrap your mind around those arguments that easy. So I'm telling you now, let whoever you know tune in. This will be some very unusual, if not historic, broadcasting. Then yesterday was HIV testing day throughout the United States. This station and many stations promoted why you should go out and have an HIV antibody test. That's fine. I have no problem. I believe in freedom of choice. But today I'll show you why I don't believe the test is legitimate, why it's a fraud. We will respond with Liam Schaaf, investigative journalist, researcher, talking about why there is no legitimate science supporting the HIV antibody test and what's wrong with it at every level. That'll be a short newsmaker piece. Then questions coming up, but always starting with the latest on health and healing. Let us begin. I've suggested throughout my entire career why the oils that go into our body become the oils in our body. they support the fatty acids. We have combinations of fatty acids, both saturated and unsaturated, long chain, short chain, medium chain fatty acids. They make up most of the matter of your brain. Without them, you can't function. And therefore, having the right oils go into your body means that you have a better functioning immune system. You have natural antiviral and bacterial and immune modulating properties when you have the right oil. Taking the wrong oil, and it produces disease. It can weaken your immune system. It can allow cancer cells to proliferate. That's why something as simple as, what oil am I using? What oil was used in that cooking? How hot was that oil? Olive oil is where we begin. The latest study from the peer-reviewed journal Neurology, just out, researched 7,000 people, and they found that olive oil helps prevent strokes. Let me quote this from the BBC. This is from the University of Bordeaux. Quote, our research suggests that a new set of dietary recommendations should be issued to prevent stroke in older people. Stroke is so common in older people. By the way, older is 50 and older. And olive oil will be an inexpensive and easy way to help prevent it. Now, by the way, there are over 500 studies as we speak today on the healing benefit of olives and olive oil. I also believe that we should be eating olives. There are hundreds of varieties of olives. We don't eat very many in this country. And I suggest having olives in our salads. Olives as an appetizer before a meal. And I would suggest like a half a cup of olives. When I go into a restaurant, especially an Italian restaurant, I don't order bread. I never eat bread. But I do eat olives. And I'll say, would you give me a little plate of olives? And they bring over a variety of olives. You're getting quality proteins, great fats, and polyphenols that can help lower your blood pressure, lower cholesterol, and help clear your arteries. An olive a day can help keep a stroke away. Let's make that a half a cup of olives. Next up, people who use sunbeds, and we see them in every city now, you're at a greater risk of melanoma, and that is serious. Most people using sunbeds are generally around the age of 30. If you use them more than 10 times in your life, you've increased your risk of a very deadly form of melanoma. This was published in the International Journal of Cancer. Why would you use a sunbed? Just go out at any time of the year where you have some sun and expose your face, your hands, your chest if you can, for 20 minutes. And you just created about 10 to 20,000 units of vitamin D and preventing cancer rather than causing it. For those of you who want to reduce your risk of heart disease, meditation. Another good study, this one in Internal Medicine, the Archives of Internal Medicine, which is published in a mainstream journal, and it shows that by meditating, we can help limit heart disease and the deaths of heart disease from all types. Now, I believe that one of the reasons for this is because when you meditate, you're focused on your breathing. That brings down your pulse rate. It lowers your cortisol level and your adrenaline level, both of which are stress hormones. Just following a calm conversation and allowing your body to relax, focusing on a vision of something that is relaxing and beautiful, like leaves in the fall or a bubbling brook in the summer or spring, or watching animals graze in a beautiful bucolic pasture, visualizing yourself by a koi pond looking at fish. Whatever visualization relaxes you, not excites you, relaxes you, that is a good meditation. Do that for about 15 minutes a day, and you could help prevent a heart attack. Calm the mind and heal the body. That's how it works. A meditative mind, slowing down your thinking, slowing down your living, Slow foods are good foods. Slow sex is great sex. Slow conversation is a conversation you can focus on. Think about the things you enjoy, like gardening, even shopping, taking your time when you shop, and enjoying it. All of that is healing. But if you get hyper, and if you get anxious, and your mind is everywhere except where you're at, then you're creating stress, and that creates an increase in your cortisol, and that can lead to a heart attack. I'm a big believer that in our sustainable future, what we're calling now a transition living, where we're going to go from where we're at to a healthier way of living, even if we're in the same place, that we have to slow everything down, unclutter our thoughts and unclutter our lives, and spend quality time just being. The other day, on Sunday, after my long run in the park with a wonderful group of athletes, I went back and went to the children's zoo and then went up to the main Central Park Zoo. And it's small. It's only, I'm going to guess, about 3 acres. But in that 3 acres, they did a beautiful job of designing little paths built into the trees and the rocks. So you walk up and suddenly you're in front of a wolf group, but they're in a natural environment. And I was thinking, how relaxing is that, just to go for a walk in the park, appreciate where you're at in that moment, in a park with trees and a breeze, and just that nice feeling of being close to nature. That is what we don't do enough. Want to live a healthier life? Then live a happier life. Want to find happiness? Keep your mind focused on what you can control, what you can do, and how you want to feel. And suddenly, you're the person who's living healthier and longer. Next up, black raspberries can help prevent cancer. This is from Ohio State University research, and it shows, quote, black raspberries are being touted as a new superfood that can help prevent cancer. And it has a lot of the phytonutrients, and is talking about ellagic acid and anthocyanidins and antioxidants. And they're calling this the king of the berries, superior to other berries. I've seen research, in fact, just this morning I finished a report I'm going to be sharing with you tomorrow on healing foods, foods that you should be bringing into your life every day. I've reviewed over 9,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature in order to make my report, which I'll post free as a public service. So if I suggest, as I will tomorrow, that a certain berry, and I can't do them all, I'll do a little bit each day, that here are the superfoods that we should be including, and I might list 20 things down a page. All this blackberry, or black raspberry, excuse me, this black raspberry, if you juice it, you concentrate the phytonutrients, and that can help lower your blood pressure. That can help heal ulcers in the stomach because it kills Helicobacter, the bacterium that causes ulcers. It can help get rid of a lot of the toxins in your intestine. It can get rid of bad bacteria. All of that I'll be sharing with you is based upon thousands and thousands of peer-review, independent, quality scientific studies. I won't list the studies at all, but I will have a source for you to go to and see hundreds, thousands of studies. I'll just give you the bullet points, down a page, talking points, so that they can register in your mind. But now when they're saying that the black raspberry goes to the top of the list, I'm glad they're looking at the black raspberry. It is certainly very good, and it will help prevent cancer, and it will help you if you have cancer. But it would be number 27. I've got 27 other berries ahead of it. So they're doing good, well, but there's a lot more they have to do. One last thing, it's not just an apple a day that we've talked about that keeps the doctor away. It's also strawberries. That's right. Why? Because the flavonoids in strawberries are phenomenal for helping you with your central nervous system and if you have diabetes. Now, mind you, my source, Science Daily, Here's what it says, and this is in PLOS One, which is one of the most respected scientific journals in the world, and this was done at the Salk Institute Cellular Neurobiology Laboratory. Quote, a recent study from scientists at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies suggests that a strawberry a day, more accurately that would be 37 strawberries, or about a bowl, or if you juice them, about a quarter of a cup, could not just keep one doctor away, but an entire fleet of doctors away, including the neurologist, the endocrinologist, maybe even the oncologist. Quote, the manuscript of this study shows for the first time, and then it goes into what it does for diabetes and for cancer, all because of the neuroprotective, quote, the neuroprotective flavonoids. And they've identified one of those called fistein, F-I-S-E-T-I-N. And that's important. So, have your strawberries, have your blueberries, and have your black raspberries, and you'll be keeping all types of disease away. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Broadcasting live from our studios and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, I'm Gary Knoll. In about 15 minutes from now, my guest, Dr. Judy Wood, will be here to talk about a completely different look based upon impeccable forensic science of the World Trade Center buildings collapsing. You won't want to miss that. But let's go over now for our newsmaker update. Let's say hello to Liam Schiff, who is on the phone. He is an investigative journalist and specializing in science matters. Nice to have you with us today.
Gary, it's great to be on your show, as always.
Yesterday we had the HIV antibody testing day. It was promoted on this and many other stations. I chose not to do a response yesterday, let people have that information, but then I want to give our information which challenges this, so please go through quickly based upon actual science that is fully documented why you and myself would not do an HIV antibody test. I had no choice because I have to get an HIV antibody test every year because of the insurance from my company, so they insist upon it, but I do it with protest. And, of course, it's always negative, but I tell them it's a garbage test, and they say, well, we're sorry, we have to do it. But for everyone else, if you don't have to have this, think well of why we are opposed to it. Go ahead, Liam.
Gary, these tests are scandalous. It's scandalous that anybody is asked to do a test that defies all principles of informed consent. These tests in the standard medical literature will tell you, number one, that they have no standard for determining or separating a reactive from a non-reactive, in other words, a positive from a negative. That's what it says in the insert of the Abbott Laboratories test, which is the first, the longest manufactured test from Robert Gallo's samples. It says, at present, there is no recognized standard for determining the presence or absence of antibodies to what they think is a retrovirus or an exosome or whatever they want to call it. You go through the medical literature, and what no standard means becomes apparent. Pregnant women, people with lupus, people with multiple sclerosis, people with alcoholic liver disease, and mice, dogs, babies, people who have been exposed to raw milk all come up positive for no reason because these tests have no standard. That's what it means to have no standard. They come up positive for any non-specific antibody response in the human body, including all those people in Africa who don't have food, who have tuberculosis, malaria, sepsis, etc. No wonder it's easy to get them to test reactive on a non-specific test.
Okay. I just wanted, and by the way, there's multiple scientific studies on this. There is more than 76 separate conditions that if you have, you could get a positive reading. And if you have many of these, let's say you have herpes and you've had hepatitis, you have a very high prevalence of testing positive. But you wouldn't have AIDS, you wouldn't have the HIV virus, but you would be treated as if you did, which means that you could have an otherwise healthy person who now tests positive, who's immediately told we must get you on antiretrovirals. And the number one cause of death in persons with AIDS in the United States is what?
Is liver disease caused by the drugs.
Is liver disease one of the 30 AIDS-defining syndrome illnesses?
It is absolutely not. It is.
So, and this is clear in all the scientific literature, of which I have and you have. I have over 30,000 studies on this. So the number one reason people are dying in the United States who are diagnosed with AIDS is liver failure. The trouble is liver failure is not one of the AIDS-defining illnesses. That's a cause directly from the treatment. And the treatment is given to people because they have the positive HIV antibody test. But unfortunately, the HIV antibody test is not positive for a specific HIV virus. And the literature shows it. Their own package insert shows it. From top to bottom, this is a massive fraud just to make profit for the people who are supporting this, and that's unfortunate. Now, we've asked these people to come forward. I've asked Robert Gallo. I've asked every single major person, including ACT UP, come on and debate me. Someone who has studied the science, has the information, and therefore don't just go on a show where the host doesn't know what they're talking about and is going to let you talk. Come on and so we can debate it. So I put this challenge out. Any member of the AIDS community that wishes to come on this program and debate me on any aspect of AIDS, I'll be happy to do so. This is an invitation we've had open for a long time, and I'd like for the public to see the arguments put forth to support a test that is a complete scientific fraud. Your final thoughts?
My final thoughts are to thank you for continuing to speak up against this massive medical fraud. There are a lot of poor people in the world. It's very easy to call them AIDS patients when they don't have any clean water. A lot of people suffering pharmaceutical toxicity, easy to call them AIDS patients. What's hard is to get this massive fraud to back off this totally. It should be this an illegal testing regimen. So I absolutely support you in continuing this work. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You bet.
And by the way, he has done a lot of work, broken major stories about governmental agencies, particularly the National Institutes of Health, Big Pharma's hidden experimental trials with dangerous HIV drugs on the New York City orphans. That was his story. Liam has been published in New York Press, LA City Beat, Salvo, and others. He is an award-winning investigative journalist, and it took him years of investigating this before he came around. As many AIDS dissenters, we do not deny AIDS-defining illnesses. Those are real. What we challenge, based upon our review of the science and working with persons individually, is the nature of the diagnosis, the test they use, and the treatments. That's what we challenge. I'm Gary Nolan. Just coming in the studio in New York City is Melissa. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Gary.
Real quick, because we have a packed show, but I know you. I said you could come down anytime you had an interesting story. What story do you have?
I have a client who came in, and he had advanced cancer, and he...
Go ahead.
...tried all the orthodox treatments, and that didn't help him at all. But I put him on a plan, and he's seen wonderful improvements thus far.
What's his name?
Kamal.
Is he on the line?
Yes, he's on the line.
Kamal?
Yes.
Hi, Kamal. How are you?
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Okay, real quick. You had cancer, a serious cancer. You had the orthodox therapy. It did not work. Is that correct?
Yes, it did not.
You then went on a protocol that Melissa gave you, and you are improving with your cancer?
Almost 50% improved in 3 months, but I haven't seen any improvement with the conventional therapy in 2 years.
So 2 years of orthodox therapy. Now you're getting better.
Yep.
Okay. Good. And your therapy was, she saw you for free, right?
Yes, she did. And she was very, very helpful. And I'm so glad I met with her.
Okay. Kamal, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.
And just so you know, people in the audience, I help terminally ill people only. And there's so many that every night, seven nights a week, every day of the year, I'm on the phone or seeing them in person. And for everyone else that may not be near death, what can I do to help them? I want to help everyone, but I can't. Not enough hours in a day. So I hire people. I hire very qualified persons. They must have a registered dietitian's degree. They must have a legitimate background. They must come from a good school in their study, and they must have a good internship with other people before I hire them. I pay them very nice salaries so you can see them for free. It's a public service I do, and as a result, probably 20,000 people have been seen for free that otherwise wouldn't have, and they get quality time and attention. Melissa is one of those individuals. You're a registered dietitian, you graduated in New York mm-hmm. University, and all the other things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Thank you, Melissa, for dropping by.
Thank you for having me.
And if anybody wants to see Melissa again, her time is free. I insist they don't charge a nickel so that you can get the help you need. That way, no one is ever too poor to get free help. 212-874-4000. 212-874-4000 for Melissa. And I tell Pat Duncanson, I tell the people I've hired, if they have something remarkable, come on the air for a moment and just share it with people, because I like to hear good stories. I like to hear when people are making progress, especially when they have been intractable and not had success elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I want to hear the person. I don't know who Kamal is. I haven't met him. But I want to know that there's a person there, a real person. I want to hear them verify what you're saying. Now, that's okay. So that's okay?
Yeah.
Elizabeth just joined us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. You saw a new film yesterday called Page One, all about the New York Times. The person who was responsible for the film was standing outside to get a cab when you came out of the theater with your friends. And you shared your perspective on the film, and I would like to know if you would share that with us, please, as to how you thought of the film. He said he was listening to you and your friends talk about the film and its relevance and why BAI is no longer relevant, or for that matter, most of the alternative media. Can you explain this in more detail, please?
Okay, well, it's nice to know people are eavesdropping on my conversations.
Yeah,
outside on
are.
The street. Not quite what happened. What happened was is one night a week, many of my buddies and I get together, and we go to a movie or a play and then have dinner. And last night we went down to Lincoln Center, not Lincoln Plaza, but I hadn't been there before since it opened up. It's beautiful what they've done at Juilliard there on 65th Street. And there's this nice theater, and I saw a movie, a documentary called Front Page. I think it's called Front Page, or Page One. And it's all about the New York Times. I thought the documentary was very well done, and I would certainly recommend it to people in this audience, as I would recommend the documentary Buck that I saw. That was very good. And Buck is about a cowboy, a real cowboy, who trains horses that no one else can train. And what he does with these horses, it's, you haven't seen this before. You'd have to see this. I mean, he'll take a horse that nobody can get on. It's a wild horse, and just in minutes, suddenly, he's on that horse, and he's petting the horse. Remember the movie called The Horse Whisperers with Robert Redford?
Yes.
That was based upon him, and he was actually there. In fact, they couldn't get a horse to do what it was supposed to do, and he said, well, let me try, and suddenly, what had taken a whole day with another horse, Buck brought in his horse, and it did exactly what it was supposed to do by Buck just being there and looking at the horse. But how would a horse know to walk across a stable, put its head in this little girl's stomach and belly, you know, like she was hugging it? How would it know to do that? And yet it did. And I just was amazed at the connection between the man and the animal and the love that he shared. What happens when you teach with love, and you extend love, the energy of love, how powerful it is versus the energy of fear. And he said in one scene of the movie, when a woman brought a horse in that was really mean and was biting people and kicking people and could kill people, And Buck came out of this corral after calming the horse down and said, this is not about the horse, this is about you. And it was one of those moments of, wow, the woman had an angry horse because she was angry, a violent horse because of her violence. And it was just one of those remarkable moments. Now jump over to this film about the New York Times. The film about the New York Times showed us inside of what it is to be the official source of news in the world. It is a great newspaper. It has wonderful reporting on many topics, and I respect that. What I challenge is, and what our conversation was out on the street last night, was that the New York Times has never taken on people within its own circle. And there are lots of examples that I knew about and others knew who were there that they are untouchable. For example, they will never take on anything about the HIV antibody test. Now, right now, there are over 3,000 of the world's greatest scientists, including Nobel Prize winners, professor emerituses, professors of virology and microbiology, who have gone on the record, not just said, yo, we agree, but put their reputations on the line by stating unequivocally and factually, when I finally read the literature on different aspects of AIDS, I was appalled. And these are top brains, but they hadn't done it until then. They had assumed that everything being done in the world on AIDS was correct. All these people are now on record. They're on my website. If anyone goes to progressiveradionetwork.com and look under AIDS dissenters, they'll see these people and their backgrounds, their reputations. Impeccable. I mean, you don't get better than some of the Nobel Prizes whose Nobel Prize came in science and chemistry that is used in AIDS research, and they're now in contempt of that, all that science that they saw was being misused. The New York Times has never sought to verify what those of us who are truly independent journalists have done. On vaccines, they've never challenged the safety and efficacy of vaccines. As a nation, we assume because of public policy, the official policy is vaccines are safe and effective. Without them, you will die or put others at risk. When we reviewed thousands of studies, we found just the opposite was true. There is no study, quality study, double-blind placebo-controlled study, to see one group of people vaccinated and another not, to follow them for a period of time and then do the proper biochemistry to see their various states of immunity and antibody levels. It's never been done. Bad science done by those who sell vaccines have been done and passed off as official science. As a result, if people are injured or sickened and die from vaccines, the first reaction is it wasn't a vaccine. Then you put a person in an impossibly difficult situation of proving the cause and effect. At no time has the New York Times or all of its reporters and all of its Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters ever chosen to take on that. They have not taken on the case of the drugging of our children, the false diagnosing of people with diseases that do not exist in reality, brain chemical imbalances we're told, such as authority defiance disorder, math disorder, parental defiance disorder, shyness disorder, social anxiety disorder. There are all these disorders that we're told are brain chemical imbalances that are requiring medication, and the side effects of some of these medication is suicide. And yet the New York Times has not taken that on to show the corruption of the entire field. You see, and part of it is this. The New York Times represents the best reporting of official institutions. But many of the best lies, the most insidious and invective lies, come from those in major institutions. So if you trust the State Department and it lies, but you go to the State Department to verify someone who's a whistleblower, and the State Department says, well, it's all untrue. If you're the New York Times, you must give your first power to the official source, which is the New York Times. As a result, if it's something that does not nail one of its own, it will report it and do so in a very good way. But what about all the truths that lie outside of the official version of the truth? What about the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy? What about the truth about 9/11? What about the truth about HARP and government environmental programs that are known by many scientists to exist and cause havoc. The official position, there is no harm. Nuclear radiation, it's no harm. The New York Times supports pro-nuclear. They supported the war in Iraq. They supported official positions, and look what caused, at what cost. So where I am opposed to official positions is the only truth, but the only truth we pay attention to and give credit to if it comes from official sources. If it doesn't, I don't care what line. If you're in education, health, medicine, physics, engineering, you must be dismissed as non-essential, non-relevant, or a quack or a nut. That's the danger of that documentary. It did not show that part of the story. If I was directing that documentary and writing it, I would have added that in. I would have challenged those reporters in ways that the film didn't. But for what he did a good job. It's a big, wet kiss and a valentine to the New York Times, which I believe will be bankrupt in the next 3 or 4 years. The New York Times is actually bankrupt. Now they had to take a $200 million loan against their building in order to have enough cash to keep it from being eviscerated. But do we need a New York Times? Yes, we do. Do we need good reporting? Yes, we do. They have both, but it's extremely biased when it comes to not touching these subjects. And now to the relevance. One of the people there, not me, said that non-commercial media has become irrelevant, and they incorporated NPR, Pacifica, NBAI, because they've gotten out of touch with what most people need and most people want. They're living by old notions, and they're terrified of their jobs being lost, so they won't make the changes in programming that would bring really progressive minds in from all walks of life to serve the real needs of people. And if you're not going to be progressive today, and you're one of these stations, you will go out of business. Because when you're no longer willing to tell the truth, you're no longer relevant. And for those who are no longer relevant, there's no place at the table. The audience will find those who are relevant. And those who are relevant have meaning and empowerment. Thank you.
Thank you.
To my guest now, who is standing by, Dr. Judith Wood, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I already gave your introduction earlier in the show and your bio. What we're going to talk about is going to be, for a lot of people, challenging to understand. So if you would please, as you're describing what you believe actually happened and your research behind it, please keep in mind to keep it in lay language so we can follow your reasoning, all right?
Yes, I totally appreciate that. Where I began was looking at what happened. You know, clean slate approach. What do I see? What can I establish? Because something this big, you kind of know there's a cover-up. You kind of know there's deception going on. There was clearly deception that day. So the best thing to do is look at the evidence that you can actually see yourself, and that's what I put together in my book. And the title of the book, Where Did the Towers Go, came from a news report on one day after 9/11, where Peter Jennings is in the studio talking with George Stephanopoulos at the scene. And Peter Jennings asks, where's all the debris? And George Stephanopoulos said, well, I wanted the same thing, and I asked one of the volunteers, and he said, it all fell down, it was pulverized, and then evaporated. And, you know, I don't in any way mean to poke fun at this. In an emergency situation, people do the best they can. They put together the best story they can, and then they just keep repeating it. Very rarely do they reevaluate it.
Hold on 1 second. Let me guide you here by asking you some of the issues that I have.
Okay.
And if you could go through them now. Let me just tell my audience that my producer and myself have taken a lot of time to review this massive test book, which I'm holding in my hand, called Where Did the Towers Go? There are just thousands of scientific references in here. This is not just some random opinions. There's a lot of science to back this up. This is forensic science. This is the type of science that you would bring into a court of law if you wanted to make a case about something. So this goes beyond regular opinion. So I won't go back to that. Where's the proof? It's in there. I have reviewed it personally. And if I didn't, I wouldn't have had this person on, because her claims are so extreme that without proof, it would be an irresponsible program to do. That said, now let me throw some issues at you, and I will keep quiet so you have a chance to explain them to our audience. I'm also letting our stations know that when we're finished with the land-based state, the terrestrial state part of this, people can continue to watch and listen to our discussion into the next hour if need be. We have already cleared this for the next hour by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. Here we go. You ready?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like for you to bring up the work of the brilliant scientist Nikola Tesla, and follow up with the work of John Hutchinson, who replicated so much of Tesla's work, such as the science of levitation. And most important, the Hutchinson effect, meaning free energy technology, something Tesla did not want unleashed to the world. And I want you to tell me what your views on that. Secondly, you stated that the World Trade Center towers did not collapse on 9/11. You stated they didn't have sufficient time to collapse because they were destroyed faster than is physically possible for a gravity-driven collapse. I need you to explain that. And one part of your argument is that there seems to be evidence that the towers were actually powdering, experiencing dustification during their descent down. This has nothing to do with explosives or thermite, which a lot of people are saying that it was thermitic devices. Also, finally, for our discussion, before we go further, discuss your research into what is called the bathtub, the retaining wall that protected the tower foundations from water, and these walls going down 70 feet below the water table. So this is all about energy technology to demolish the towers, and that differs from conventional explosives or bombs to bring them down. So take us now step by step through your forensic work, how you came to this, what your science was, and then your conclusions, and then we can hold them either to be valid or invalid. We can accept or reject them, but at least we will hear you out so you can make your best arguments.
Okay. Best way to start is with the last questions. It's important to start with first determining what happened, and only then how it happened, and only then who did it. But so you first need to establish what happened. What happened is that the towers didn't burn up and they didn't crash down. They turned into dust, mostly, you know, like at least 80% of them turned into dust in midair. How do I know this? If they had crashed down, you could look and see what was left over. You'd see a pile of stuff. That was missing for the most part. Also, if they had crashed down, you'd have a seismic signal that showed that, and that is missing as well. Also, if they had crashed down, lower Manhattan would have been flooded because of the bathtub, would have been, you know, broken bathtub. The towers were actually built in the Hudson River, the foundation being about 70 feet below the water table, so there's this dike called the bathtub that's built around the towers to hold the water out. If you drop a 500,000-ton building on that bathtub, it's going to damage it. It's going to break it. You're going to flood Manhattan, flood all the subway tunnels that connect in there. And that didn't happen. Also, let's talk about the North Tower. The ground shook for 8 seconds. It takes 9.5 seconds to drop a bowling ball off the roof and have it hit the pavement below. So, you know, how could that be? That the only way it could be is if the building did not slam to the ground. And then I started looking at if the top 80% or so turned to dust and blew away in the wind, and you only had the lower 20% and dropped that to the ground, you'd get about the seismic signal that was recorded for the North and South Towers. Building 7 is even a more dramatic issue, because some of the seismic stations recorded no seismic event accompanied with the demise of this 47-story building that was about 230,000 tons of material. Some of them recorded just barely, you know, using a lot of imagination, maybe there's something out of the background noise, but essentially there was no seismic event. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of evidence that shows the buildings did not slam to the ground. There's a lot of rumors about steel shipped to China, as though that's to explain the lack of material. But the material was lacking that day on 9/11 and thereafter. Also, if you look at the photos, you see steel flying through the air, like the outer panels, prefabricated panels of I call them wheat checks because they kind of look like the cereal wheat checks. The units, they're three columns wide, three stories tall. They're flying through the air, and they sort of dissolve or melt like ice cream with this dust trailing out the back. And you look at the ground where they were aimed, and they should have landed, and there's just paper there, paper and dust. Also, various first responders all talked about this total blackout. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. The only way that could happen is if 100% of the sunlight was blocked out by this dust, the fine dust that went up. No collapse, no controlled demolition has ever, you know, gone up and blocked out the sunlight, which is another issue. But then you have other things like the toasted cars. Now, I came up with a new terminology to keep from biasing my observations. If you say burned cars, then you think fire is the cause. What I mean by toasted, as in its history, is toast. It can't be repaired. There's something happened to it that destroyed it in some way, kind of a unique way, without damaging people or trees around the vehicles, which was pretty bizarre. For example, up West Broadway, every single car got toasted. No trees appeared to be burned. Unburned paper in the streets, no burned bodies. So that's a peculiar thing. Then we have the testimony of firefighters going up the street talking about cars spontaneously lighting up as they pass by them. And some people had their shoelaces catch fire or their coat catch fire. But they don't talk about being hit by anything, you know, no flying debris that was on fire that caught them on fire. And if a building falls down because of fire, because of bombs in the building, or what have you, how can it toast cars a quarter mile away, half a mile away? And there's 1,400 cars reportedly toasted in southern Manhattan that day. It doesn't happen with, you know, collapses or controlled demolitions. So there's this lack of debris. And again, you first start out with the evidence. And that's essentially all I show is the evidence, and the evidence leads the way. I kept tabulating this evidence and more phenomena until, you know, the picture became quite clear. But one of the interesting things is about the so-called jumpers. There's pictures of people hanging from the 105th floor, disrobing. You know, so you think, what would cause them to do that? If it's a fire, you want to keep your clothes on for a protective layer. If it's a fire, well, I'd run to the bathroom and wet myself down, and or the sprinklers would come on, or if nothing, no sprinklers came on, you'd be sweating because you'd be hot and you'd be wet. So chances are these people are wet. So it appears that they want to take off wet clothes for some reason. Well, we do know certain energy fields affect water differently than they affect dry skin, like microwaves. And, you know, I can't think of any other reason why people would be hanging from the outside of the 105th floor taking their clothes off. It's not to get cool, and it's not because they want to die, because, you know, they're hanging on. Page 32 is in the book is a particular picture of someone. And there's other people who are disrobed, partially disrobed, and so forth. Another interesting part of it is the elevation map that was taken afterwards, showing what was left or what kind of wasn't left. It's on page 191, and you see these two little pimples that point out saying people survived here. And the testimony of one of the people that survived there, and that's like in the second or third or fourth floor of the North Tower, 14 people survived in stairwell B. One of them said, and this was Jay Jonas, I looked and said, guys, there used to be 106 floors above us, and now I'm seeing sunshine. There's nothing above us. That big building doesn't exist. And later he said, these are the biggest office buildings in the world, and I didn't see one desk, one chair, one phone, nothing. And another firefighter from there was calling out to his buddies, you know, the Mayday. And he said, we kept telling them, you know, stairwell B, second, third, and fourth floor. And they kept saying, where are you? Second, third, fourth floor, stairwell B. He said, you could hear. They didn't understand where we were. And I kept going, my God, aren't you listening? And they finally said, where's the North Tower? I was like, what do you mean, where's the North Tower? So, you know, the people from the outside saw nothing left and had a hard time believing there's still some humans in there. They're alive. A similar thing happened in the base of Building 3, which usually gets ignored. It was a 22-story building, which is, you know, a small skyscraper or big skyscraper for some small towns. And there was this little bump at the end of the building that was left, this little kind of pimple compared to the whole ground, and like two or three floors. And there's people that survived there and walked out. But the rest were missing. Building 4, the main body, went missing. It's in that picture on that figure on page 191, where the main body is just gone, essentially, down to the ground. The north wing is still there, but sliced off. It's with an X-Acto knife. You know, if you had binoculars, you could look in and see what was on somebody's desk. What was really strange is across the street from that, there's double-paned windows with only the outer pane with a hole in it, and the inner pane is still intact. A rounded hole in the outer pane only. And that is, you know, can be reproduced with longitudinal energy waves. So we have, you know, various things going on. The lack of debris, the toasted cars, lack of seismic signal, the bathtub still intact, toasted cars, also flipped cars. You know, why would cars be upside down with, you know, leaves still on the trees around them? There is evidence of levitation. Some of the first responders, you know, one thought that, again, people put the best story together with what they have. The person thought they died. It was God picking them up and carrying them down the stairs because they wondered how they floated down the stairs. There's also testimony from a photographer there who was lifted up and carried a block. He said he was running, and then this 1 minute his feet were on the ground, the next second his feet were off the ground. And he's carried about a block.
Okay, Dr. Wood, I'd like to address some issues specifically.
Okay.
Tell us about the tornado warnings off Long Island, the thunder reported by airports that few people know about, and why is this important? And also tell us about the Earth's magnetic field on 9/11.
Okay, you know, there's more data. As I was looking at, you know, all this dust that went up, I wanted to get a better image of it. So I began looking at weather satellite images, and then, wait a minute, I saw this huge hurricane. I wasn't aware there was a hurricane on 9/11, and I went back and looked. It's Hurricane Aaron. It was the first big hurricane of the season. I think it was the biggest one of the season. It had more cyclonic energy in the storm system than Hurricane Katrina. It was headed towards New York City for 4 days straight. But, you know, people in Manhattan weren't told there might be a hurricane. It might turn around beforehand, but it might get there, and you might want to think about, you know, evacuating, you know, voluntarily, and we'll tell you when it gets closer and what's going to happen. But that didn't occur. In my book, I have images of the weather report that morning, 10 to 15 minutes before the North Tower got its hold, before the first event of the day. And the weather map shows that patch of the ocean, but does not show the hurricane that belongs there. On pages 40 and 41 of my book, I have, you know, as shown, and then I have the hurricane superimposed where it should have been.
Yeah. Well, just hold your thoughts, because we're leading up to what Dr. and Professor Judith Wood's hypothesis is. But we're going to say goodbye to many of our stations. You can continue listening to this interview. I will continue this interview till I am satisfied that we're fully aware of her theories. And you can listen at progressiveradionetwork.com. If you forget that, go to GaryNall.com. Dr. Judith Wood, former professor, Clemson University's Department of Mechanical Engineering, specializing in the research of thermal stress and deformation analysis with optical imaging and biomaterial composition and biomimicry. And she's an expert in any of these optical methods of stress analysis to determine interference patterns and their effects. She's authored 60 peer-reviewed scientific reports. She looked at 40,000 images and video clips, read volumes of witness testimonial. Her findings led her to file a federal case for science fraud against the contractors who controlled the official 9/11 Commission report. Her research has been published in this 500-page methodically referenced book called Where Did the Towers Go? And we're going to talk about what all this means in a few moments, but we don't want to get there before we look at all the other possibilities. So now we have all these unusual but not necessarily connected weather patterns. Again, these are pieces of her puzzle that she is bringing together to try to show us why her arguments are legitimate and should be considered. If she were a lay person on any of the websites spouting off what she has written about, I would say that it was not credible and not to pay attention. But spending hours reviewing her material, I am convinced that we should give her the benefit of a doubt and let her have her opportunity to tell her story. We can accept or reject, we can consider it legitimate or not, but freedom of speech and also openness to ideas means we must consider all ideas. Hers are certainly capable of being defended at a forensic level. And all of her work, I might mention, is forensically backed, meaning she could go into a court of law and present her evidence, and you would have a hard time challenging it. Let us continue. I have a few more ideas. I want you to explain the Earth's magnetic field on 9/11. I want you to explain what happened with the fires in the building, and also the argument that it was the molten steel from eyewitnesses that they saw that caused the fires, and would that have been enough heat to have caused the collapse?
We're jumping around a bit here.
All right.
With regard to the hurricane, to note, again, this is a fact. It's not a theory there was a hurricane there. But, you start looking at what do hurricanes do. Well, birds know a hurricane's coming because of field effects ahead of the hurricane, outside of the cloud bands. There's, like a static field. And the fact that we, have documented thunder at the three main airports, JFK, LaGuardia, and Newark Airport, are examples of field effects sensed there that day. That's just all the data. No theories, just, evidence. And back to this long list of strange anomalies that I just kept adding up, and I believe in letting the data speak. The data will tell you what happened if you listen carefully to it. If you don't know, keep listening. So listening to it, and I kept tallying these things up, I ended up one day, happened on somebody's blog, and my goodness, it looked like all of the same phenomena, just replicated. It turned out that was the blog of John Hutchison, who has replicated the work of Nikola Tesla and others. But the thing about John Hutchison is that he lives in the here and now. You can go visit him and see it for yourself in front of you. You don't have to take somebody's word for it out of a textbook or whatnot. Tesla isn't around now. But John Hutchison is. And so I went to visit him, and I witnessed these effects. And very unusual effects, but it's so amazing that it's the same hallmark. So it seems it would be the same kind of mechanism involved, which got me looking at more things, the interaction between weather systems and the Earth's magnetic field, and all sorts of magnetism, electricity, gravity, they all interact. People say, okay, that's weird. How can you get something from nothing, like the free energy idea? Well, what is it that you get from moving a conductor through a magnetic field? You get electricity, thanks to Nikola Tesla. And I think we've all done this as a kid. You wrap a wire around a nail, plug it into a 9-volt battery, and you've turned that nail into a magnet. So we know there's a relationship between magnetism and electricity, and also wrapping the coils around. Well, think about it. What is a hurricane? It's a supersized Tesla coil. And that's probably how you get field effects. So let's consider also what you get with this type of weather, with this torsional weather system. You get cars sitting on telephone poles. And you get strange things like straw embedded in trees. Dissimilar materials fused together. And it's not because the straw is flying fast. And I've got some pictures in the book of a 2x4 through a tree or a piece of plywood through a palm tree. And also I have a picture of a car. This is from Hurricane Wilma. The car is sitting on a fence under a roof. It couldn't have tumbled there. You know, wooden fence. So it's you know, precariously kind of balanced there. And also, that was in 2008. There's a bunch of tornadoes in the Midwest. And there was somebody who said, I swore I could see cars floating. He was quoted quite a bit in the various news articles. Yeah, that's what happens with these weird weather systems, is levitation. Now, and people say, where does this energy come from to destroy the World Trade Center? There isn't enough energy on the planet. That's what my detractors like to say. But what about a tornado that destroys an entire city? You know, you don't stop and say, well, that couldn't be a tornado because there isn't enough energy on the planet to destroy the city. It's what I'm suggesting here is that it's the same type of energy. That it comes out of what seems to be nowhere, this energy system where it's a combination of gravity, electricity, and magnetism. And once you learn the right key of how to access it, we could provide free energy to the planet. And this is what Nikola Tesla had suggested, but he didn't want to unleash this for fear it would be used for evil purposes. Well, been there, done that. So that danger is no longer there. So I think it would be wonderful if we could use this for good, for providing clean energy to the world. It would change the economic system, that's for sure. But the energy is limitless.
All right, I've looked at the photographs of everything that you have discussed up to this point, and the scientific charts, and that you have all the emergency vehicles and the cars that were far away from the actual collapse. If any materials from a building that is free falling at the speed at which it did landed on those cars, that is a completely reasonable and legitimate rationale for why the car was damaged. If any high heat projectiles landed on a car, that could cause a scorching. The question is, did any of that happen to the cars, and what caused some cars to spontaneously combust, or not to combust completely, but to develop this scorched or toasted effect? That is certainly worth pursuing. My concern is that we have a phenomena. And as a scientist, I've studied energy. I was studying energy when I had to do it quietly because nobody wanted to believe in it. And yet at the Institute of Applied Biology, I was seeing people, including a professor of nursing at New York University, Dr. Dolores Krieger, a picture of her at my laboratory doing this research showed that she was able to heal 6 out of 6 cancerous rats. At that time when I took my research, 50 people of whom 6 were able, including Rabbi Abraham Wiseman, Dr. Morton Jacobs, Dr. Thomas Kruth, and others, could heal, the director of the Institute looked at me and says, and what do you exactly want me to do with this? I said, well, I've done this over a 2-year period. We've done it 6 times. It's proving that an energy force is capable of going from a person into a mouse and heal him. And he says, yeah, and we're not going to do a thing with it. And I said, why not? He said, because no one's going to believe it. It goes against all the current laws of physics and science. And we cannot afford to jeopardize the reputation of the Institute by making us think that somehow we're doing voodoo science here, he said. I said, this is just good science. It's showing that energy can be affected from a person, from a mind to another creature. I said, but isn't that the same thing with love? Isn't that the same thing with passion? Isn't that the same thing with intuition? He said, stick with anti-aging research that we'll publish. So I had to do all my own research on Psy Research quietly because people were not open for the results, even though I did it for 25 years. Now what you're telling us is that there was a force, an energy field that was capable of causing this destruction. In order for us to accept this, we have to have you prove to us, A, what would have been the motive for doing this? B, what would have been the means to do this? You're not talking about someone in a laboratory doing this. You're talking about this would have to be an awful lot of people working and having an intent. What would there have been their intent? What would have been their resources? Where would this have been done from? And why is it that no one else up to this point, including over 1,600 engineers, architects, physicists, structural engineers who are now opposed to the official position. They've gone on record. We have looked at the official 9/11 Commission report, and we find gross flaws. Therefore, we need a new independent group of experts to come in and give us a new report. Yours is totally aside from that. You're the one person out of all those who is saying, hold on a second, I have a different theory. You haven't been given the opportunity. In fact, if anything, you've been challenged. Now answer, if you would please, my challenges to you. Show us why someone would have done it. What means could they have done? Is there a possibility that people working with HARP or any of the other secret government programs on energy alterations, that we do know exist, that we've had people. Yeah. Give us now the evidence to show us what happened and what you think happened, or what you, because it's a hypothesis with interesting footnotes and evidence until we are convinced otherwise.
Again, a scientific investigation, forensics investigation, begins with determining what happened. That's not dependent on who did it or how they did it. What happened? And that's what I have determined as to what happened. I have shown other technologies, examples of it. That's empirical evidence still. So I'm not saying, you know, what serial number is, what parts it was, where it was located. That doesn't determine what the evidence is. The evidence speaks for itself. The empirical evidence just it is. It's factual. It's not an opinion. Like if somebody's wearing red shoes, That's not a theory. You know, if you look and see they're wearing red shoes, or if they say they're over 6 feet tall, if you can get a tape measure and measure from the floor to the top of their head, that's evidence that they're over 6 feet tall, providing that's what the tape measure reads. But, you know, we could spend all the time debunking other, you know, speculations and so forth, but that doesn't determine what happened. And what I have tried to do in my book is to show what happened, to categorize all of the evidence, and then I also show other ways of producing those same phenomena. I don't say that, you know, is exactly how it was done, but it shows that this, you know, other people have done it. There's a patent on it from George Pigott, and almost exactly 100 years ago he applied for, or he was awarded the patent on levitation with projecting energy, but there's things that it really defy any other explanation. For example, on page 263, there's a picture that is often used by the thermite promoters to say it's molten metal. Well, if it's molten metal, it should be a horizontal puddle. But also, and they say it's, you know, it's glowing hot. If it's hot, if it's glowing because it is hot, you know, the paper should be burning that's in the pictures.
I'm looking at this picture now. What I see is a whole lot of paper around a fire. Wouldn't we assume then that the paper, if it's that close to the fire, would be burning?
Right. That would be a very good assumption. Also, this, you know, bright yellow glow.
Yes.
Aluminum melts at 660 degrees centigrade, lower if it's an alloy. The towers were built out of a steel structure with aluminum cladding all around the outside. And so here's, in this picture, some aluminum cladding pieces sitting there. If it's hot enough to glow, you can see from the temperature chart, then it's like 1,200 degrees centigrade. Well, the aluminum should be a puddle. It shouldn't still have its shape. Yet we see what appears to be glowing aluminum cladding. But, you know, not to mention the paper. So there's a problem there. But as I say on that page, hot things glow, but not everything that glows is hot. You know, let's look at a fluorescent light bulb compared to an incandescent bulb. They're two different mechanisms. One is hot, one's not. So just because it's glowing does not necessarily prove that it's hot.
Okay, let's bring this back for people. By the way, we've just now set a record. I'm looking at our computer, people watching and listening to this program. So congratulations for getting an audience. They're interested. Now let's make our point. For people just joining us, we're listening to Professor Judy Wood. She is claiming, and she has created a forensic investigation textbook, The Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. She is showing us the anomalies. She is showing us charts and photographs. She studied over 30,000 slides. Now, I'm not going to talk for you. I want you to give us, again, if you were to summarize everything that you found was wrong with the official version and wrong with even the thermitic explosive version, go through now what you say is wrong with the 9/11 findings, and especially with building number 7, that clearly is a question that has not been answered. Take us through your arguments succinctly.
Well, there's so many. We'd be here for weeks. One particular thing is that a myth that gets passed around again is this high heat thing. There's this USGS map that actually the photo was taken by NASA. Something else was taken by USGS, superimposed by JPL, and they produced this thermal map that supposedly shows hot spots. On page 272 of the book, there's on the left side image, there's this thermal map. And if you notice at point E, that's the edge of West Street in front of Building 3, and I also have a picture on 9/11 of that same location where a water main had broken and flooded the street, like a lake. And on page 274, there's firefighters wading in knee-deep water at that location. So you can't have molten metal at the bottom of a swimming pool. When water becomes steam, it expands in volume by 1,600 times. And you have a steam explosion. Also, point F on that thermal map coincides with the location of figure 279 on the next page, where these guys are climbing down into the basement of Tower 2, where it looks like there's a water puddle down there, and they're definitely not in an oven cooking. So this story of molten metal and hot, the pile was hot, it was melting steel-toed boots. That's another myth of, think about it. Steel-toed boots are melting. Well, if my steel oven is melting, the turkey inside is well done. But there's no reports of burned feet. So how would shoes be melting, or boots be melting, and not burning feet? Also, all of the hydraulic equipment that was operating on the, quote, pile, that's a biased impression as it is, but, it can't operate above 82 degrees centigrade without permanent damage to the hydraulics. And, I'm not saying that things weren't glowing. Hot things glow, but not everything that glows is hot. You can also think of fireflies. They glow, but they're not hot. And then you have fumes coming out of the ground. The fumes came out, years later. There's also testimony of, folks three-quarters of a mile away feeling the heat from the World Trade Center, rescue workers crossing the Manhattan Bridge. What were they really feeling? They perceived it as heat. But if it was hot, that hot over there, wouldn't you think the paper next to the World Trade Center would have been burned? Also, you see the dust cloud that rolls down the street. It mowed people down, left them covered with dust, didn't burn them up. There's several of them that have told me that the dust cloud was initially cooler than ambient temperature. Initially cooler than ambient temperature. Then they felt the dust was really itchy. the dust also broke down and continued breaking down finer and finer and finer until it started wafting up and people were inhaling it. And some of this dust that was, or a lot of this dust that was measured was on the order of the size of DNA, you know, like a hundredth of the size of a red blood cell. Just imagine what that does to somebody inhaling it. So, you know, it's pretty strange. Like a block upstream or upwind from the World Trade Center, about 10 to 15 minutes after the North Tower went away, you see blue sky in the distance, and then pretty soon you start seeing what I call fuzz balls around people's feet, and then pretty soon it starts rising up all on its own. You see also partly disintegrated steel. Chapter 12 is about that, where it looks like the steel is just kind of half dissolved or been eaten out or eroded away in an amazing degree. There's the mid-air dustification, that's the word I applied to it. A new phenomenon needs a new word to describe it. If you look at page, for example, 138, you see this material coming down, and you see it, you know, coming apart as it comes down. And the pictures on page 139, it looks like an Alka-Seltzer tablet, effervescing. That's steel coming down from the building. Figure 129 is the intersection that you see. You saw some of this, steel heading towards, and you just see paper and dust there primarily. You see a couple of pieces of aluminum cladding, but you don't see these big steel wheat checks headed there.
What happened to them? How could steel evaporate and go to dust? What happened to it?
Turned to dust.
How can steel turn to dust without heat? It's not possible.
It is possible. You see it happening. It comes apart. Now,
I understand. I'm looking at your pictures, and you see all these steel pieces, and these are rather large, you said, right?
Yeah, they're three stories tall by three columns wide.
And I'm going to guess in this one picture there must be at least 150 of them.
Right, right.
So all of those started out, we see them in a picture. The picture's real. It hasn't been phototouched. But those don't end up on the ground. They turn to dust. The question is, what rule of physics was just changed to allow steel 30 feet high, weighing a lot of weight, to turn to dust in midair? That goes against all laws of physics. Now, here's another thing that I don't think anyone's ever discussed. In some of the photos, and I was down at World, I the only day I've ever in my life ran south. I always run north. I came in that morning, I flew in that morning from Florida, and I took a run down, and I was there when all this happened. I knew it was going to happen when I heard the plane. I said, my goodness, that plane's too low. Looked over my shoulder, and there it went, boom. In fact, there was a member of the Secret Service there, and he yelled out, Gary, we got to help these people. And he knew me, evidently, and I'm in Washington. I've been on Washington Radio, our sister station, PFW, for 25 years. So we were trying to help what we could, and a lot of the phenomena you're talking about, I saw this with my own eyes. But, of course, I thought I was seeing, a building imploding and exploding, and I was not looking for anything other than what was happening in that moment. Of course, you're trying to help people and get out of harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when people went out of the window, you, I believe, and you can tell us this, I could be wrong on this, but as an athlete, I could not imagine someone going out that far that they went out from the building, because I do track and field, and I know how far people can jump. And get into the air, even allowing for gravitational pull and wind, they couldn't get as far out of the building as what they seemed to be. Now, is that an illusion on my part, or is that accurate?
That's accurate.
So people ended up going further out into the air than what was physically possible to jump.
Yes.
And there wasn't, we didn't see the explosion coming behind him, which could have caused a substantial projection. If you have an explosion behind you, the projection and the energy, the force field that precedes that explosion will throw you out, much like someone running from a barn and boom, it explodes and you get thrown 30 feet. We're not talking about that. We're talking about people going out of a window and suddenly their body is further out into the air at a lateral position before the free fall. That's a phenomena that I would like to hear explained. Would you give us your explanation for that, please, your hypothesis?
I don't put out, you know, hypothesis or theories on this. I just note this is not logical. I even calculated compared to, you know, the early 1900s Olympic record in the standing broad jump. I thought that was a good comparison, you know, with how much oomph somebody could launch with. And that wasn't even enough to get them out that far. And we also have records of body parts, you know, several blocks from the World Trade Center, which need explaining. People in free fall tend to reach terminal velocity above, you know, a certain level. And beyond that, they don't go faster. Let's say 80 to 100 miles an hour. If you hit a deer going 80 or 100 miles an hour, you kill the deer probably, almost surely. But you don't, separate a toe here, a finger here, you know, and an ear over here, and a piece, you know, the stuff gets busted up and it's left in one place. So that's another issue that's of question. It's a painful place to go to, but it's another strange thing. There's testimony of people coming apart on the way down.
What do you mean?
In Chapter 3, I have a testimony from one of the first responders saying he just looked out the window for a few seconds. He said, I didn't need to see it. He saw somebody clip the edge of the roof of Building 3, looking out the window from the North Tower. And then he said, there's no longer a person, just as a cloud of red.
Could there be anything that would have caused their body to come apart in midair?
Well, if the building's coming apart, you know, you kind of wonder if it's the same type thing. And the buildings were coming apart in midair.
In midair, they were going to dust, something that you say is not humanly possible.
Well, I didn't say it wasn't humanly physically possible. I have seen John Hutchison's work. When he does what he does, some materials turn to dust.
Okay, but he is the exception here. We're looking under normal rules of physics.
Well, you can say, you know, before Tesla came up with the hydroelectric power plant, was that normal rules of physics?
I understand. Now, we're running out of time, and I'd like for you to summarize, what do you believe at this point, based upon your evidence, was the actual cause of the 9/11 buildings collapsing?
There is one image I would like to discuss on page 133 that my detractors like to have a different interpretation for. This is from the North Tower. The building goes away and is just left with a cluster of core columns standing about 700 feet tall or so, well above the height of Building 7. And then you see a crisp edge of the columns, clear sky in the background, and then it comes to a point where you no longer see a crisp edge, and then you see dust hanging in the air. They claim that the thing tipped over, and that was dust that shook off of the columns, that had settled on the columns. Well, if those columns are left standing, just, you know, as the rest of the tower is going away, how did dust settle on those columns, the vertical columns? You know, how could the dust settle instantly, yet be so fine that it's hanging in the air, you know, a few seconds later?
Well, hold on a second. I'm looking at the pictures on page 133.
The lower set.
In the lower set, you have five photographs showing a water tower, and then you show the vertical columns. Are these in complete sequence as far as time?
Yes.
Well, then the first shows the column intact. Then the second column starts to bend The third starts to dematerialize, and then the fourth and fifth are pure dust. So if what I'm seeing is correct, you're seeing a demineralization and dustification of a solid steel column without anything to be a contributing factor to it dematerializing. That's
exactly.
What I'm saying. Is my observation correct or incorrect?
It's correct.
And whoa. I mean, this is weird.
Dustification before your eyes.
I'm seeing this, I'm looking at this, and since these are actual time sequence, it is impossible for this to be the shadow of dust, because what would cause dust to be in the same position and hanging there? That's not possible. You're not going to have particulate matter hanging.
Yeah, detractors like to say that the dust shook off the columns and the columns fell over.
Well, no, it doesn't show that. You would see the column falling over. You don't see a column falling over. You
right.
see a column disintegrating into dust.
Exactly.
I mean, this is...
And also, you know, how would that dust have gotten to rest on the column in 2 seconds, yet be so fine that it hangs in the air, you know, later?
No, but the point is, where it would be the column after it fell? There was no evidence of that particular column after it fell. You would then say, okay, well, there was dust, and now you have a column that fell.
And on page
you don't have that.
Right, on page 135, I show the fall zone. You know, it would have taken out other buildings if it fell over.
Well, what do you... Now let's go to the final issue of the day.
Okay.
And I only have 5 minutes left here. Tell me what you believe from your evidence as a scientist, as a specialist in this field, that is an unusual field. It's one of the more esoteric fields of science. What do you believe your evidence shows you actually happened?
A type of interference of energy fields. And I'm not saying where they came from, who operated the buttons or whatever, but this is an energy effect. Something we also didn't talk about was particular vehicles where there's this, you know, abrupt line between toasted and not toasted. You know, that's something that's familiar to people in interferometry, because things happen where you have interference, they don't happen where you don't have interference. And so it's a way of controlling, because it's not a natural fire. Fires don't have an abrupt stop where 1 nanometer to the right is pristine and 1 nanometer to the left is totally toasted. That's not what fire does. It's, you know, black, white, shades of gray around the perimeter. And so, but you can get this through interference of energy fields. And I had come to that before I found the work of John Hutchison, and his work interferes radio frequency signals within a static field. And he used to use a Tesla coil, and later was using a Van de Graaff generator to produce a static field.
So you believe, I just don't want to misstate your case. You're believing the evidence is directed by free energy technology. You're not claiming who or where this emanated, but you're claiming that a person or persons unknown had the knowledge, the technology to direct free energy to this, and this is what caused this explosion.
Right. What I consider directed energy weapons is energy that's directed and is used as a weapon. This isn't random action. This is directed, and it's energy. It's energy that travels through space. It's not a kinetic energy weapon like bombs or something that physically, you know, moves something.
Do you believe this could be tied into the HARP program? Do you believe this could be tied into weather patterns around the world?
I don't go with beliefs.
Okay,
one thing I will say about the HARP system is, you know, whatever, it, you know, well, first of all, you know, I filed a federal QI-TAM case about this. The dismissal of it came with a note from the judges saying that they acknowledged that the law applied to my case, but we're ignoring the law for the ease of dismissing the case. And so, you start thinking about why. Well, you know, that was very respectful of them to say that. But thinking about it, this is classified technology. Somebody's classified technology. Do you want that in a civil courtroom? And if you have it behind closed doors, you're admitting that it's classified technology by doing that. So it's somebody's classified technology. If it is classified technology, it's not going to be in the public domain by definition. So whatever things we know about are in the public domain. I don't know what HARP does. I know what we're told it does, but I don't really know what actually goes on behind the curtain.
All right, well, you've stuck with the points that you can prove. You brought a lawsuit. They acknowledged the lawsuit had a legitimacy, but chose not to allow you to engage it. We could only speculate a hypothesis as to why. I would surmise that under discovery and depositions, if there was any secret program doing this kind of work, it would be weaponized, weather control and energy control. And if it was in just about 11 years ago or so that the Pentagon finally, under a Freedom of Information, acknowledged that over a period of 30 years they had engaged in 1,900 separate secret experiments on Americans in cities without their knowledge or consent, just in radiation research alone. And before that, they had disavowed, they had denied, they had said they'd never do that. No one was ever held accountable, and simply everything was wiped clean, but we did know that they did this. Now, in October of 1989, I did an original feature cover story for a national magazine based upon evidence I had uncovered and had independently verified of secret experiments by our government's agencies. I even tracked down some of the scientists who engaged in those secret experiments, and I did that cover story. And that led to showing how our government had been lying and doing secrets. Now I have to ask, what again is our government doing that we're not aware of that could be adverse to our well-being, and what would be their motives? There's a lot of questions unanswered, but at least you've opened a door to a new set of questions that we should be asking and have some answers, if nothing else, at least to challenge the official position. All right. Well, all we know now is that we have enough forensic evidence to ask legitimate questions, to have new set of hearings, to try to bring all this out under oath and have independent experts review the information rather than the absolutely absurd, almost as if you were to put the Marx Brothers running the 9/11 Commission. It was so filled with nonsense, fraud, that even a pro government person would still have to acknowledge it lacked objectivity. Dr. Judith Wood, thank you very much for being on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Judith Wood, former professor at Clemson University's Department of Mechanical Engineering, and she specializes in an esoteric area of science, thermal stress and deformation analysis with optical imaging and biomaterial composition and biomimicry. And she has published over 60 articles in peer-reviewed literature, and she spent years of looking at these anomalies and then examining them with thorough forensic information of what she believes caused the actual World Trade Towers to collapse. And she's put all of her evidence, which is formidable, into a book called Where Did the Towers Go? I've not seen this anywhere. I haven't seen where it's even available, quite frankly. But this is a woman who can stand behind what she says. Now let's see what we make of it. My job is to present information in a form for those who have something to share that is challenging. It is for us to decide whether we choose to believe it or not, to accept it or reject it. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you very much for listening and watching. I will have another program with another set of experts and professors next week to continue with a different theory on the Building 7. I will also be doing an in-depth report on the Bilderberg Group. I did not do it last night because new information has come in last week, and I'm building upon that to make the case even stronger and more credible about who really is behind the power structure of our society and throughout the world. I don't want to in any way share information that would be immediately dismissed. I want to have information that could withstand any court. That's the standard I use before I bring information on the air. We'll also be doing a program, an in-depth program, with scientists on the different chemtrails and also on HARP. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.